college students, I see you. Some of you are coming back in. Welcome back. Glad you're here. We love you. We miss you when you're gone. When you left, we were in Exodus. Good news, we're still in Exodus, chapter 34. So if you want to grab your Bible and turn there, that would be a good thing. We'll walk through this together. Glad you guys are here, and pray the Lord will use our time together for for His glory and for our good. I'll catch you up a little bit, though, in case you've been gone in Exodus. What's been happening recently is Moses was on the mountain for 40 days, and while he was up there, the people that were still there in the camp, they made a golden calf to worship. And Aaron, who was kind of like the associate pastor, was the one that made it. And then God called them a stiff-necked people. He threatened to kill all of them because of their idolatry, which they earned, rightfully had earned His wrath. He is compassionate to them. He sends Moses back down the mountain. Moses gets to the camp. He loses it. He burns with anger, I think is what it says. And then Moses naturally takes the golden calf and pulverizes it and puts it in water and makes the children of Israel drink it, okay? Which is what you would have thought he would have done. And then God tells him, hey, Moses, I'm going to send y'all into the promised land. This is chapter 33. I'm going to send y'all into the promised land. I'm going to send my angel ahead of you to drive the people out, but I'm not going with you. I'm going to send you in there, but my presence will not be with you. And Moses says back to God, God, please don't send us. We don't want to go if you're not going to be with us. We don't want to go into this land without your presence. And so here in at the end of chapter 33, God is telling Moses these things, and he's walking Moses through these things. And Moses says to him, he says, please show me your glory, which is this unbelievable statement of Moses. And we'll see why that matters here in chapter 34. He says, show me your glory. And then God tells Moses, he says, you can't see me. If you were to see my face, you'll die. Okay, no one has ever seen me and live, because God is so holy and man is so sinful that man can't see God's glory and live. And so God tells Moses, I'm going to hide you in the cleft of a rock, and I'm going to pass by. I'm going to put my hand over you, and I'll pass by, and you can see my back, but you will never see my face. So that's what's been going on here in Exodus. We're here in 34, okay? I'm going to go ahead and tell you up front. The word whore is in here, and I'm a seventh grader, okay? So just need to have that in your mind before we get there, okay? But it is a fantastic warning for us. So the Lord said to Moses, cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke, okay? Moses physically broke the tablets when he came down off the mountain. The people of God symbolically broke the tablets when they broke the law, okay? That's what's happening here. And so there's a reestablishing of the covenant that God is making with His people that's going to happen right here. You're going to get some more stones. You're going to come up the mountain. I'm going to rewrite them down for you, which you broke, Moses, and which y'all broke, Israel. Be ready, God tells Moses, by morning, and come to the mount up to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. No one will come with you. No one can be seen throughout the mountain. Let no flock or herds graze opposite the mountain. So Moses cut two tablets of stone like the first. He rose early in the morning and went up on Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him, and he took the two tablets in his hand. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, and this is a really important verse, okay? You're going to, all throughout the Psalms and in many of the prophets, this idea, this phrase, this declaration of who God is repeated over and over and over again, okay? And it's first seen here, tells us who God is. And when you read these things, this is who God is. You wonder who God is. Maybe you've heard people talk about God, like He's like, you know, the big man upstairs or whatever dumb, you know, thing that you hear people say about God. The Bible tells us who He is, and here's some great characteristics of God. We didn't know that. You want to know what God's like? You want to know who God is? It tells us who He is right here in Exodus 34. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the father of the children on the children's children, third and fourth generation. Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. And he said, if I found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people. And pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your inheritance. Okay, who God is. If you like to fill in blanks, you can grab this little piece of paper. There's quite a few of them on there today. And we'll just take this in sections. But we want to see who God is clearly first, and then we'll walk on from here. Now remember, okay, God has brought them out of Egypt. He has provided for them just time after time after time. Here they are. They get to Mount Sinai in the wilderness. Moses goes on the mountain. While Moses is on the mountain, they build a golden calf, and they even say, this golden calf brought us out of the land of Egypt, even though like just a few days ago they made it. I mean, it's ridiculous in many ways, right? But it's who they are. It's what they've done. They are a stiff-necked people. They will not bow their heads to the Lord in obedience and worship Him and follow Him. And yet, God continually, even though His wrath burned against their sin, He's gracious to them, He's merciful to them, He's kind to them. And this declaration of who God is here is important. So if you want to know who God is and what He's like, we should go to the Bible and see what He's like and see what it tells us about Him. A few things here that it says. This isn't all that God is like, but these are certainly some of the characteristics of God. First is this: God is merciful, okay? He's merciful. I mean, He's sympathetic to our weaknesses. Or God's mercy is seen in that He doesn't give you what you deserve. All right? We get that in our minds. I don't get what I deserve because God is merciful. And I said this a few weeks ago, but I'll say it again. I hear this from time to time, particularly when people are walking through difficult times or somebody they love walks through difficult times. I hear people say, I just want God to be fair. And I would tell you, no, you don't. Okay? You don't want God to be fair. Because a fair God sends every one of us to hell. Every last one of us goes to hell if God is fair. We do not want God to be fair. We want Him to be just, and He is just, thanks be to God. But you don't want God, you want God to be merciful. You do not want God to give you what you deserve. And He does it. Thank God He does it. These people deserve to be annihilated in this moment, okay? What does God do? Shows them mercy. He's merciful to them. Second thing, He's gracious. He shows us undeserved favor. These are two words we flip around in church, okay? But let's make sure we get them right. Mercy is God not giving us what we do deserve, okay? Grace is God giving us things that we don't deserve. So mercy, we don't get what we do deserve. Grace, we get what we don't deserve. And the grandest pictures of those is the fact that God doesn't send us to hell is merciful. The fact that God gives us eternal life and adopts us into His family is grace. Okay, that's how those two things work together. I know those are big ideas, but man, that needs to marinate in our hearts and to see who God is. Third one, good one. He is slow to anger. Isn't that good news? That He's patient with us. God, our Father, is slow to anger. God the Father is not like Jeremy the Father. Jeremy the Father is not slow to anger a lot of days, okay? Jeremy the Father is like a firecracker to anger, you know? It's just like, boom, and I can go from really chill to, you know, screaming. Ask Jenny about it. She can tell you about it pretty easily. And that's where God's not like your father, okay? He's better than your father. He's better than my father. He's better than me as a father. He's slow to anger. So anger does not mean that God does not get angry. He obviously does get angry, right, at sin. He righteously gets angry, but He's slow to anger. He is patient with us. Next, He's abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Abounding, meaning there's more of it than you could ever imagine, in steadfast love and faithfulness, meaning that He always follows through with His love and the promises He has given to His people, okay? He abounds in steadfast love and faithfulness. Always does what He says He's going to do. Maybe not in your timing, maybe not the way you would have wanted Him to do it, but He abounds in His love for you and in His faithfulness to you. It's what He does for His people. Even people that create golden calves and worship them and take the glory that is due to God and give it to a graven image. Even to those people, especially to those people, He is abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. And lastly, he is forgiving. And I love this picture. The Hebrew word here that is translated forgiving means to lift or to carry. So literally, this picture here is that God takes away our sin by lifting the burden of our sin and guilt off of our shoulders. So we are burdened with this sin. And what does it look like for God to forgive us of our sins? He removes that burden from us and takes it on himself. That's a beautiful picture of who God is. And then the right response of Moses, I don't want you to miss this. This is who God is. Who are the people? The people are idolaters, right? They're worshiping something, someone other than God. God is gracious, merciful, slow to anger, rich in love, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, forgiving, right? It's who he is. What is Moses' right response? Worship, okay? The right response. When you see the sinfulness of man, you, me, and you see the holiness and the mercy and grace of God, what should we do? We should join in Moses in what he does here. He bows his face to the earth in humble worship. Who am I, right, that you are mindful of me, that you would love me this way? Oh God, he says, please let the Lord go in our midst, up into the promised land he's talking about. For it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your inheritance. Man, it is a beautiful picture. We see God for who he clearly is and his love for us. And so God's going to give them a warning now, okay? A really strong warning about what they should do when they go into the land, which I'm going to tell you up front, we're not going to get into this today. God warns them here, and you think they'd be like, got it. Then they totally do what God tells them not to do, okay? Which sounds like people I know. Me are those people, by the way. Verse 10. And he said, behold, I am making a covenant. Before all your people, I will do marvels such as not been created in all the earth or any nation. And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Man, it is. So here's what you need to do. So God says, like, I'm going to do this, okay? I'm about to show y'all how awesome I am. I'm going to drive these people out, and this is going to be crazy. You ain't ever seen nothing like this before. That'd be the Alabama translation of those first few verses, okay? You ain't never seen nothing like what I'm about to do in your midst, okay? Now here's what you need to do. You need to observe what I command you this day. Do what I say, okay? Behold, I will drive out before you the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. But you need to take care, okay? Or be careful. It's like, I'm about to do this. You need to be really, 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 really careful. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you go, lest it become a snare in your midst. You shall tear down the altars and break the pillars and cut down their Asherim, for you shall worship no other God, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous God. I'll explain it to you. He's not jealous like your eighth grade girlfriend was jealous, okay? He's jealous for your good. It's for your good that God is jealous for his glory. We'll get to that. He says, so when you move into the land, tear that junk down, okay? Tear the altars down, burn it to the ground. Everything there that is not about me, you need to burn that junk to the ground, okay? It's what you need to do. Lest, verse 15, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and when they whore after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and you are invited, you eat of his sacrifice, and you take their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons whore after their gods. Josh said I can only say whore five times. I think I'm over the limit already. You shall not make for yourself any gods of cast metal. Okay. He says, warning. That's a really strong warning, right? I mean, like, you read that, and you're like, whoa, wasn't expecting to hear that at church today. It's just God saying, hey, look, man, when you go into the land, I'm gonna do something awesome. I'm gonna drive all these people out, I'm gonna give you this land that you didn't build, you're gonna have vineyards that you didn't plant, cities you didn't, all this stuff. I'm giving you all this, okay? When you go in, you got a responsibility, and you need to be careful. And when you go in, you see things that are false gods, false altars, false worship. These, you need to tear it down, get rid of it, burn it, okay? Get rid of that junk. Because if you don't, here's what's going to happen. It's going to become part of who you are. Okay? And so how do you fix that? You got to get rid of it. You got to get rid of this false stuff. Otherwise, it's going to become part of who you are. And the point here is this, I want you to get. Idolatry that isn't destroyed will end up destroying you. That's a strong warning. Okay? Idolatry that isn't destroyed, it will end up destroying you. And idolatry here, yes, is talking about false gods that they were worshiping in the land. But fast forward to today, we understand that idolatry, John Calvin said that the human heart is a factory of idols, right? We make an idol out of anything that we see that is good. Anything we worship besides God is idolatry. And so we very easily in Southern American Christianity, we take good gifts that God gives us and we turn them into gods to worship. Okay? Marriage, children, money, sex. I mean, just name it. Good gifts that God gives, and we worship them. And we set up worship in our hearts, thinking that those things are going to satisfy our souls. And the reason why God says to them, hey, tear this down, because I'm a jealous God. I'm jealous for my glory because my glory is for your good, okay? God's not jealous like, don't you be worshiping. No, that's not how he is. He knows what will satisfy your souls, and it's him. So he doesn't want you worshiping these false things. These false things are not satisfying. Don't worship them. You got to tear the idolatry down, okay? Tear it down in your life. If you don't destroy the idolatry will destroy you. And so here's the point that's not in your notes that I wanted to be in your notes, but I decided not to put them in your notes, okay? Is this. Idolatry will make you a spiritual whore. Okay? It will cause you to worship not just the one you were designed to worship. It will cause you to worship others. And if you and I aren't careful, when I worship anyone or anything other than God, I am behaving like a spiritual whore. And so we need to be careful, right? And we need to say, I can't do this. This is not honoring to the one God who will satisfy my soul. And so I gotta make sure in my heart that, like, I love my wife like Christ loved the church, but I don't worship her, okay? I need to be careful not to do that. These children that God has given me as a blessing. Okay, children are a blessing of the Lord, blesses the man whose quiver is full of them, right? They're a blessing. But they cannot bear the weight of thinking they're going to satisfy my soul and me worshiping them. Your job can't do that. Money can't do that. Sex can't do that. Those are all idols that will not satisfy you. Will not satisfy me. So I've got to know that, and I got to fight against that. Otherwise, my heart's going to be divided, okay? In the Bible, what he's saying here is, if that happens, you're not going to worship me. And spiritually speaking, when you worship more than me, you're not committed to the one true God. You're acting like a spiritual whore, and so you don't need to do that. So how do I fight against that? I won't say the word again. How do I do that? I think this is how we do it. The next point is this. We got to continually put to death that which is sinful in us, right? How do we fight idolatry? By the mortification of sin, right? By putting to death that which is sinful in us. That's how we do that. When we see sin in our lives, when I feel that, when I feel myself putting the pressure on those things, I gotta see that, and I gotta put that to death. Colossians 3:5, and we don't have time to talk about this, but this is, don't forget that these letters that Paul wrote are to the church. These are Christians he's writing to, okay? So to the church, he says, put to death, therefore, that which is earthly in you. Sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. Okay? Paul makes this connection for us. That these are things, this is idolatry when we do this. When we worship these things, we've got to put these things to death in us. Otherwise, if we don't destroy these things, they can end up destroying us. They can end up destroying us. James 1. Let no one, when he is tempted, say, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed, underline this if you have this open in your Bible, by his own desire. Like, it's probably not the devil tempting you. Okay? I mean, it might be. He's not everywhere at all times, though. What's tempting you is probably you. It's probably the idolatry in your heart that you haven't put to death. What's tempting you is the sinfulness inside of you that is saying to you that this will satisfy me. I know that's true of this guy, okay? It's probably not the devil. You're probably being lured and enticed by your own evil desires that you have not put to death inside of you. You haven't mortified your flesh correctly. And there's a warning here, right? Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is a full-grown man, it gives birth to death. So you got to put it to death early. Don't let that junk grow, okay? Don't let it grow, don't let it grow, don't let it grow, because when it grows, it'll destroy you. It's a good warning for us. All right, we're going to get into the section on feast and the Sabbath, which we've already talked about here extensively. So I'm just going to read over and give you a little bit of a highlight of it, but if you have questions about the feast and the Sabbath, you should go back and listen online because it's all there. You shall keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib. In the month of Abib, you came out of Egypt. All that open the womb are mine. All your male livestock, the firstborn of the cow and the sheep, the firstborn of the donkey, you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you don't redeem it, you shall break its neck. All of the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you shall work, and on the seventh day you shall rest. In plowing time and in the harvest you shall rest. You know what that means there? You don't get that. Well, it's just a busy time of year. Okay? This is my busy season. No, rest. When it's plowing season, you rest. When it's harvest season, you rest. You don't get the rest. 3 times a year. I lost my spot there. Oh, okay. You shall observe the Feast of Weeks, the first fruit of the wheat harvest, the Feast of the Ingathering at the year's end. 3 times a year, you shall all your males appear before the Lord your God, the God of Israel. For I will cast out nations before you and enlarge your borders. No one shall covet your land when you shall go up, appear before the Lord your God 3 times in a year. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifices with anything leavened, or let the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover remain until the morning. The best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Duh. And the Lord said to him, we said this before, I don't really know what he means by that, okay? But just don't do that, okay? If you're thinking about boiling a young goat in its mother's milk, just stay away from that one. Just be careful. And the Lord said to Moses, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and nights. He either ate bread or drank water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the 10 commandments. Okay, quickly, a word about the feast and the Sabbath rest is this. The feast and the Sabbath are woven into the rhythm of their lives, and it's meant to point them to God's love and faithfulness to them, okay? And to remind them that he is the one that is their redeemer, he is the one that is their provider, he is the one that is their sustainer. So God weaves work and rest into their lives, and he says, I want you to rest. Every week, you need to take a day of rest. And don't come at me with, it's tax season, okay? I don't care about that. Don't come at me with, well, you just know fall is the busy time of year for us. No. Mm-mm. Doesn't work like that. Okay? Well, I just got to get this project off the ground. No. When it's plowing season, when it's harvest season, I don't care when it is. 6 days you work, 1 day you rest. And as you do that, you are going to be reminding yourself that you're not the one that's holding this thing together. That God is. That God is the one that is making these things work. He made your body to rest. He made your body to stop. And I can tell you this in my own life, and I can spiritualize it because I can say that I'm working for Jesus, right? But I can promise you this, man. Most of the time when I don't rest well, it's because I believe in my self-sufficiency. And I think that these things are happening because of what I'm doing. And it's not causing me to trust that the Spirit's moving and working, and I just get to be part of that, okay? So let's be careful with that. And again, I said this before. If you see that in me, man, I hope you would tell me, okay? And if I see it in you, I'm going to tell you because I love you. Hey, let's be careful with this. And it's supposed to remind them. The feast of the Passover, of the ingathering, the feast of the harvest, all these things. This is meant to remind them that God is the one that has redeemed them. He has bought them back out of their slavery. He's the one that provides for them so that when they, you know, when they plant their fields, God says, I want you to have a feast when you plant. I want you to remember before a stalk of corn grows that I am the one that provides for you. Okay? Before anything happens, before you see any fruit, you need to remind yourselves that I'm the one that provides. Otherwise, you know what's going to happen? You're going to think you did it. So you're going to have this feast. When you plant your field, you're going to have this feast, and you're going to tell yourself, and you're going to tell your children and their grandchildren and grandchildren that God is the one that provides for us. Okay? And then when you harvest, and you see this bountiful harvest, you're going to have another feast. You know what that feast is going to remind you? That I am the one that not only provides for you, but I'm the one that sustains you. As you get ready to go into the winter and you look at your storehouses and you say, have I got enough for the winter? You're going to have this feast. This feast is going to remind you, God is the one that sustains me. I don't sustain myself. I haven't done this on my own. God is the one that's done this. And so I want you to have these feasts. I want you to have the Sabbath to remind yourself that I am the Lord your God and I am the one that is doing these things. So, Moses came down from Mount Sinai. That was my transition. With the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, he came down from the mountain. Moses did not know that the skin of his face was shining because he had been talking with God. And Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. You would have been as well. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to them, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken to him on Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. We'll get to the why of that in a second. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came out. And when he came out, he told the people of Israel what he commanded. The people of Israel would see the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face was shining, and Moses would put the veil over his face again until he went to speak with him. So Moses is, what happened to your face, Moses, right? That would be the question here. Moses apparently is coming off the mountain and his face is shining, and that would have been weird for any of us to see, okay? And so why was that happening? Why is Moses' face shining? Here's why. Because of something we read in chapter 33. When Moses asked God to show him his glory. We're going to see this in 2 Corinthians, all this come together. But Moses asked God to show him his glory. God apparently does show him his glory, even though he doesn't show him his face. He does show him his glory. And Moses' face was shining, literally reflecting the glory of God here. Okay? He'd been in God's presence for 40 days, and he asked God to show him his glory. So when Moses came down off the mountain, he is glowing, literally, shining as he reflects God's glory. That's a great picture, okay? That's good. Well, how does that point us to Jesus? We read that, and we always want to see what the text says and understand it, but then we quickly want to go, well, how does this point us to Jesus? I'm really glad that you asked. Here's a Reichen quote about that. There was something glorious about the law, okay? The law is glorious. There's glory in the law that God has given. The Israelites could see it in Moses' face, which was shining so brightly that they could hardly bear to look at it. However, the law could not bring full and final salvation, and thus, whatever radiance it had was fading away. Its glory was true, but temporary. So we see Moses, because of the law of God, okay? God, he has been in the presence of God. God has given him his law, the good law that is glorious. And Moses' face is shining as a reflection of that glory. Well, juxtapose that with the gospel. What do we know about Jesus? What about Jesus and the glory of God? Moses reflected the glory of God. Hebrews 1 tells us this about Jesus. Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God, an exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. And after making purification for sins, he sat down to the right hand of the majesty on high. So, again, the law, Moses being representing the law, reflects the glory of God. Jesus and the gospel radiates the glory of God, meaning that it comes out of him. One is like a mirror. One comes from him, okay? He is radiating the glory of God because he is in himself the exact imprint of the nature and character of God. 2 Corinthians 3, 12 through 18. I hope you can get excited about this because I think it's a beautiful picture of the law, the glory, and the veil, okay? We see it in 2 Corinthians 3. He says this, Now, and this is talking exactly about what we've just seen, okay? This is a fast forward talking exactly about what we're talking about. Now, if the ministry of death carved in letters on stone came with such glory, and it did because Moses' face is shining, that the Israelites could not gaze at Moses' face because of its glory, which is being brought to an end, will not the ministry of the Spirit have even more glory? For if there was glory in the ministry of condemnation, and what he means by that is the law brought our understanding that we were sinners, right? The law does not redeem you. The law condemns you. The law shows you your need to be saved, your need to be forgiven, right? Nobody reads the law and goes, yeah, we're good, okay? Like, we can't even keep the Ten Commandments, much less all of the law. The law condemns us. It shows us how sinful we are, and yet there's glory in it, right? There's glory in it because it shows us that we've broken God's commandments. But he says, if there was glory in the condemnation, if there was glory in the condemnation, the ministry of righteousness to this gospel must far exceed it in glory. Indeed, in this case, what once had glory has come to have no glory at all because of the glory of that which surpasses it. For if what was being brought to an end came with glory, much more will what is permanent have glory. Since we have such a hope, we're very bold. Not like Moses, who put a veil over his face so that the Israelites would not gaze at the outcome of what was being brought to an end. But their minds were hardened. For to this day, when they read the old covenant, that same veil remains unlifted, because only through Christ is it taken away. Yet to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their hearts. But when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. And now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And we all, with unveiled faces, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. Okay? Here's the picture here that this is how it points us to this glorious news of Jesus. This is the last point there. The gospel of Jesus is more glorious than the law, just like Jesus is more glorious than Moses, okay? The law points us to our sinfulness and our condemnation, and it is glorious that God would do that. It is a great, look, when you recognize your sinfulness, that is a grace of God. Because a dangerous place for you or I to be in is to think that we don't need God. To think that I'm okay on my own, that I'm a self-sufficient man. No, you're not, okay? You're a sinner that has rightfully earned the wrath of God. So there's grace in the law, and there's glory in the law, but there's much more glory in the gospel because it radiates the glory of God, and because Jesus Christ himself, we see our sinfulness, we see our condemnation in the law, and then we're given righteousness in the gospel. Because, not because we're good, but because God made him to be sin who knew no sin so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. The good news of the gospel is that Jesus Christ is more glorious than those things. And what has he done for you and for me? We all with unveiled faces are being transformed from one degree of glory to another. He is making us more like Jesus. Our faces aren't veiled to this good news, but we can see it clearly. We can see the glory of God for all that he is. And then what he's doing in us in that is he's transforming us. Like this, the more you, I should have put this in my notes, but the more you look intently at Jesus, the more likely it is you're going to become like Jesus. Right? Like the more I study his word and see him and the veil's removed and look clearly at him, he's going to transform me from one degree of glory to another. He's going to make me more like him in that. Okay? And so I want you to get this, the takeaway. And I land here on Saturday nights, man. I have a hard time cutting my brain off on Saturday nights because I'm like, what do they need to walk away with, Lord? What is the thing that you need to walk away with? Here's what it would be, okay? First, make sure you see. I don't know what you think about God. I don't know what your preacher told you about God growing up that wasn't true. I don't know what, you know, your life experience has made you think about God, but see in the scriptures who he is merciful, he's gracious, he's slow to anger, rich in steadfast love and forgiveness, okay, to all who will call on him. That's who he is. And the good news of the gospel is more glorious than anything you could have ever imagined. So what you and I need to do is we need to be careful, right? As followers of Jesus, let's be careful Let's be careful that we don't let idols get built up in our hearts, because if they do, if we don't destroy them, they'll end up destroying us. So see that as a warning. See it as a warning and pursue the Lord in that and do what he's called you to do. Be careful. Take heed. Tear that junk down, right? Don't let it build up in your house, because if we do, it can end up destroying us. And it is the grace of God that he would even tell us these things, and that he would show us how glorious he is and how much he has loved us in Christ Jesus. Would you join me as we pray together? God, I'm thankful today for your word. Thank you for a chance to hopefully see it clearly and truthfully. Thankful that you're forgiving, you're gracious, you're kind, you're abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, slow to anger. Thankful that of the just this radiance of the glory of the gospel of Jesus Christ, it shines brighter, changes us, conforming us into your image, transforming us from one degree of glory to another. And so, Lord, help us lay aside the idols in our hearts and lives. Help us to tear them down and burn that junk to the ground so that it doesn't build up. And that's going to be probably a daily struggle to continue to put to death that which is sinful in us. And that's where we need your Spirit to help us to do those things. So, God, thank you for this word. I pray that you would use it to conform us more to the image of your Son today. I pray that in Jesus' name.